Well, good morning, everyone. The Live Dharma Sunday for July 24th, 2011. This is Reverend Koyo Kubose here. I'm your host. So glad you've joined us in telephone land, cyberspace land. I know that we've had a little heat wave here a few days ago, and then we passed it on to the Midwest, and now over in the eastern part of the country, you're getting a little heat. Indeed, Mother Nature is always doing something. Well, today, our guest for giving a Dharma glimpse is John Mio Wilder of DeKalb, Illinois, and he was a member of our first lay minister group that started way back in 2006 and finished up with and graduated with his induction ceremony in May of 2008. So, for today's Dharma glimpse, may I call on John Mio Wilder, Sensei?
Thank you. Sad to say, I actually arranged my vacation this year so my family and I could be home August 14th so we could attend the midnight showing of Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2. We had to get there early because our local theater actually showed Part 1 at 9 so we could get a refresher before the final movie in the series. In case you're unfamiliar with the series, the plot of the final two movies revolves around Harry and his companions searching for Horcruxes, objects where the villain, Lord Voldemort, has hidden pieces of his soul, making himself potentially immortal. The problem is that Horcruxes are difficult to destroy. In fact, even after finding one, our heroes have to carry it around because they can't find anything powerful enough to harm it. Now, in the second book and movie, Harry did manage to destroy a Horcrux without knowing what it was, using basilisk venom, after using the magical sword of Gryffindor to kill the basilisk. All this means is that in Deathly Hallows Part 1, our heroes learn that they can use the sword to destroy Horcruxes, because when it killed the basilisk, it absorbed some of its venom, because, being goblin made, of course, the sword only takes in that which makes it stronger. Watching Part 1 again for, well, the third time Thursday, and having read the book at least that many times, that line finally struck me. The sword only takes in that which makes it stronger. I realized I need to be more like that sword. How many times during the course of a day do I take in the negative words or attitudes of people I encounter? How easy it is to let someone else's bad mood or bad attitude become my own. An angry patron at the library where I work, a grumpy coworker, an irritable spouse, all can ruin my outlook. Only take in that which makes me stronger. Of course, that doesn't mean just praise, but, like the Sword of Gryffindor itself absorbing basilisk poison, taking in that which helps destroy my own delusions. But, importantly, also to reject that which weakens me, that which fuels my anger, my selfishness, my negativity. To only take in that which makes me stronger. May it be so. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for a nice Dharma glimpse. Only take in that which makes us stronger. I remember my father wrote an article. I don't remember if it was in Everyday Suchness or The Center Within. I think the title of the article was Foreign Gates. I think the message was similar in the sense that everyday life, what we let in a sense, we are sort of gatekeepers to our own consciousness, our own lives, and and what influences us. Sometimes, I guess, when things happen in the course of daily life, things that perhaps irritate us, or sometimes we react, have a knee-jerk reaction. We lose our temper, get impatient, as opposed to controlling the gateway to what we are allowed to affect us. What is this about this that we kind of fundamental in a sense, you know? What do we allow in? And most of the time we feel, the ordinary person like us, we feel we didn't have a choice. Something got foisted on us. We had no choice. That was the rude person that upset us. And this happened and that happened and we didn't have a choice. And in a sense, we don't have a choice about what happened, but we do have a choice about how we're going to react, whether we're going to just dismiss it or not. And as the Buddha said, when you get famous, there's a lot of jealousy. And the Buddha was no exception, as I understand his life story, because he was famous in his time. And as he traveled, and local teachers would sometimes challenge him about certain issues of the day, or, well, how do you feel about this? Debate him, and perhaps unfairly criticize his views. He never got upset. Sometimes his chief attendant, Ananda, after one session, asked him, how come you never get upset when people criticize you and everything, subject you to unfair verbal abuse, unload on you? And the Buddha said, well, Ananda, if someone offered you a plate of filth, would you accept it? Ananda said, no, if it was filth, I wouldn't accept it. I wouldn't touch it and get dirty. And the Buddha said, well, if you don't accept it, who does it belong to? Ananda said, well, it still would belong to the person who was holding it. The Buddha said, that's correct, Ananda. You see, when somebody criticizes me, well, I look at it, I consider it. And if it has some validity, if I feel it has something perhaps that I could learn from, then I'll take it in and learn from it. But if I feel it doesn't, then I just ignore it because it doesn't have anything to do with me. And I think in many times, it's easy to say and hard to do, but when somebody sort of attacks us verbally, if we feel that it is not really relevant to us, it really has nothing to do with me. In a sense, the person is upset, angry, because of his own issues. That's the reason he's saying what he's saying. What he's saying has more to do with his own problems than being a criticism of myself. Okay? That person has some problems. Okay? He's not feeling very good about himself. And so he somehow has to feel he has to tear others down in order to build himself up. Or sometimes, I don't know where this was, but I heard the saying, what you are is so loud, I can't hear what you're saying. And it's another way of saying, this person is expressing themselves, exhibiting things that come from the fact that he's having a hard time, a hard day. And as I said, it's easy to say to understand this, but hard to follow through and not get upset when oneself is a target of some kind of verbal abuse, even though it is uncalled for. And I think being a human being, we all are susceptible to irritation. Nobody is, well, a so-called saint. Or, if you want to put it this way, even a saint, a human saint, has their limits. And so I think sometimes it is instructive to realize that it's not all or nothing. One doesn't have to be 100% a saint. One doesn't have to be 100% patient in all circumstances at all times. No one's perfect. Everybody's a human being. But that doesn't mean then that, oh, therefore then I have to rationalize or I'm a failure, and we have to whip ourselves that we were not patient enough or we were not Buddha-like enough. Everyone has to be themselves, and sometimes we have our vulnerabilities in certain areas or certain times that other people might not have or that we might not have at other times, and that's perfectly understandable and acceptable. So I came up with a little model or conception that helps me. Because sometimes people, even in self-improvement, say, maybe this is a variation of perfectionism, where people feel, oh, if I can't be perfect, then I'm not good. It's not worth the effort. And you'd be surprised what kind that this subtle psychological quirk in people is quite active. It's actually an excuse for not doing anything. Well, if I don't have the perfect conditions to write the great novel, then I'm not going to even try. I've got to have everything perfect. Or if I can't do this perfectly, then it's not worth it. If I can't be a perfect Buddha, what's the reason for a trying? Well, you know, we have a problem if you have that kind of attitude. So how does one understand great teachers, people that we admire, our spiritual heroes, those around us, ourselves? I think that even our greatest spiritual heroes, let's say I'll take my father, the Reverend Gyomei Kubose. He rarely got mad. He's very patient. He hardly ever said a mean word. Lost his temper. Now, I don't know the dynamics of how he became that way exactly, you know. But I do know there was quite a bit of congruence between his public and private personalities. You saw what you got, and a lot of people, they could put on something, a good face persona in public, but in private, then you saw something that was not quite as desirable. They were very short and impatient and get angry with family members or staff members around them. But my father was the same in public and in private. But he could be human, okay? But it took a lot to knock him off his center. And if he was knocked off, he was able to let it go pretty quickly. No matter what happened in one day, if there was something upset him in family doings, the next morning it was gone. It was a new day. So I was thinking that the reality of spiritual growth and so-called sainthood, or you know, this aspect of perfectionism, or you know, Buddhahood-like qualities and everything like this, the virtues, the kinds of ideals, spiritual ideals, wisdom, compassion, kindness, understanding, all of these things, it's a matter of degree. And we're making a mistake if we think that we should be perfect, 100%, or, you know, and that we're failures if we are not perfect all the time, in all ways. That's irrational. I think my father was what I call a 90-10. Just for the heck of it, I put this kind of model. He had a strong spiritual center of gravity. Sort of like one of those bobo dolls or daruma dolls in Japanese culture. Pear-shaped doll, and you weight it on the bottom and then you knock it over. Well, yeah, it bounces back and forth, but it recenters itself. It took a lot to knock him off his center. He had a strong spiritual center of gravity. So 90%, that's pretty solid. Whereas I think most of us are maybe 60-40. 60% of the time we could put up with things. And that's not too bad. You know, if it was 50-50, or let's say if it was 51-49, there's only 1% that very thin veneer. And it doesn't take much. It's like a walking time bomb for someone to lose his temper, get angry, act out. But if you could get, well, maybe I might consider myself a 70-30, which is not bad. You know, most people, maybe they're 60-40s. If somebody's 80-20, I think that's a pretty good definition of sainthood. If you're 90-10, wow. And I think that's a very realistic way of looking at the situation, and that if one is 60-40, that, and he wants to improve acquiring these desired spiritual qualities and virtues, following the paramitas and so forth, the Eightfold Path, engaging in right speech and right effort, that he can improve, you know, from the 60-40 to 65-35, and always feel that he's moving forward. And of course, in a way, I guess in Buddhist cosmology or philosophy, sometimes it is said that when a person dies, he becomes a Buddha. Complete parinirvana. You know, where that's the only time you really become perfect, is when you're not a live human being anymore. Okay? And then you can be an example for others, because you're not subjected to the usual karmic influences and so forth as a live physical human being. So these are some of the kind of things that I think play into the complex motivational aspect of spiritual growth, and how sometimes we self-sabotage ourselves by unrealistic, perfectionistic notions, and we're not superheroes. And yet we could, even superheroes, I think it's no accident that Superman has kryptonite right there, or that Achilles had his vulnerability on his heel. Even the gods had their vulnerabilities. And this is a great lesson. And that's why we humans, we have godlike qualities. But neither side is all 100% perfect like this, okay? Or perfectly bad, even. This is a very realistic, healthy attitude toward life, and that we need the effort, and yet don't self-sabotage ourselves with unrealistic viewpoints. So that's all for today's broadcast, and till next time, you keep going, and have a very beautiful, realistic day today. Thank you.